and welcome to this episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Phil Brandon and Joe Kirk. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
So this is
episode 131. Sorry,
yeah,
Jazz.
My voice has changed. I've morphed into Phil. Yeah, as I was going to say, episode 131. this week's session was Beyond Consent Part 3 for special categories of data. So we started off with the news section, as we always do, but this week we dedicated it solely to the EU-US data privacy framework, because that's recently been approved. So that was a really interesting topic of discussion, which we unraveled. And there's still questions around it, for me anyway, that haven't been answered yet. So I'll be intrigued to see how that develops, especially around Section 702 of FISA. But then we also obviously broke down the lawful basis under Article 9 of the GDPR, beyond consent. So substantial public interest, employment, social protection and social security law, and so on. Cue Phil or Joe.
It was, we did. I thought you were just going to do the whole thing on your own. We did. I thought it was a good session, actually. I mean, I enjoyed prepping for it, because again, it made me read and, you know, critically read the Data Protection Act Schedule 1 and you know, unpack parts of it. Like, we talked through the Not-for-Profit Foundations Article 9.2d, didn't we? Mm. And unpacked that and used as a working example about how those conditions might work. So I thought it was quite good. We had a lot on the chat. I lost track of the chat, I'm afraid, so I apologise for that. What did you think, Jay? Did you think it was enjoy it? Good session?
I did enjoy it, yeah. Special category data is always quite interesting, isn't it? Because there's obviously so much more you need to consider in order for you to process it. There was a time halfway through where you two were talking about social protection law and employment law, and it was a little bit over my head. But I really enjoyed the session, and I did enjoy picking through the privacy framework at the start as well.
The problem really is that we've said this is the third time we've talked about lawful basis for processing, and this time we talked about special category data. So it's taken us 2 weeks to plow through six, you know, the six lawful basis for processing for personal data, and there's just such a lot here in special category data. I don't know that we need to do another session on it, but yeah, we talked through some of the substantial public interest conditions, like racial equality of opportunity and treatment and anti-doping in sport. But like, there's 40, aren't there, in Schedule 1 DPA? And if you're going to step through them, particularly the ones that people are going to use, like, you know, employment and criminal and, you know, children and people at risk, you know, it's almost like, you know, a quarter of an hour on just or each one, because they're so caveated, aren't they? But we didn't put that. I don't know if you think we got through the topic in sufficient detail. I guess our listeners will tell us.
Yeah, that's true. You feel free to. But I think for me, we spoke about what we see the most across our range of our customers. So there are, you know, certain bases or even conditions within bases, such as under Schedule 1 for substantial public interests, that we see time and time again, such as equality of opportunity and safeguarding of individuals at risk and children and so on. Crime prevention and detection, so for, you know, a few substantial public interest conditions, and then obviously employment laws are a common one as well. So that was the main bulk of the session, really, because that's what
we specialize
so
in.
Much.
It's the most commonly found ones,
yeah,
as far as that.
Yeah, an interesting discussion on data made public as well by the individual, manifestly made public.
Yeah, I thought that was quite, I like things that are thought-provoking and make you quite question, you know, where are the parameters and so forth. And I thought the explicit consent discussion was good as well, because, you know, why is it different from consent? Surely if consent is meeting Article 7 requirements, why is it not explicit? Mm. Anyway, listen to that conversation, see what you think.
We'll avoid it going into it again. But yeah, I hope you all enjoy the session. If you've got any ideas as well for what you would like us to discuss on a certain session, do let us know, or you can go to our website and view, you know, existing podcasts. They're all there. But yeah, I hope you enjoy the session. I think this week we've agreed that we'll dedicate it purely to US adequacy.
Just because the news or the whole session?
It's hot topic. Well, the news.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Has there been anything else in the news? I haven't really seen much more in the news other than that.
I've seen a few things.
Yeah, there's been a few bits, but thought we may as well save them for next week before you get overexcited, Phil. And just break down this...
put me back in my place.
break down the US adequacy decision a little bit. So what was
interesting is that Joe that found out and sent a circle around like, within about 2 seconds of it being published. I was thinking, I won't worry about that. I'll read it in the newspaper tonight or on the BBC or something. And I didn't hit the news at all as far as I could see. And two days later, I was on the phone to a customer who knows his onions. And I mentioned this EU privacy data privacy framework. And he said, what? I said, US adequacy. What? So it doesn't appear to have been particularly well publicised to me.
No, perhaps not in the UK. And maybe that's because it doesn't directly impact us right now, I guess. Me and Jasmine joined a webinar actually yesterday that OneTrust did on it, and they had some very high up people from the US, and I'm not sure who they were, or they had these fancy titles, and I can't relay
president
them to you.
Vice president and
something along those lines. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, okay.
I was hoping that they were going to break down the framework, talk through the principles, and what's different from that and to Privacy Shield, but it was nothing like that. It was really disappointing. Actually, I did take some key takeaways from it, but for an hour long session, it really wasn't that useful, to be honest with you. So I was a little bit disappointed, and I think you were as well, weren't you, Jasmine?
Yeah, there was a lot of just stating what we already know, to be honest, and the fact that, that this will be implemented and there'll be new measures that are required. But they weren't going into the detail of these measures, and it was really frustrating, actually. It was just a lot of waffle, but there were a few bits, like you say, Joe, if you want to break those down, at least.
This is
the EU, isn't it? I mean, the UK is going to follow suit. I mean, Rishi went over there and came back with this data bridge. Like, oh, we're going to beat the EU. We've got this data bridge. Next thing is EU say, we've already beaten you. We've got this agreement in place. And the UK will absolutely, definitely, in my opinion, follow suit and back it.
Yeah, there were talks on the podcast yesterday or the session yesterday about that being considered, the US-UK one in the fall.
So we have to wait, do we?
Coming autumn, apparently.
So the US data bridge is the extension to the data privacy framework, and that's what's going to come in play in, as Jasmine said, in fall or autumn, as we know.
We've had a few people saying, well, what should we do? One of the things I did this week was I scheduled to spend 3 hours with Vicky working through some standard contractual clauses and addendums. And, so we set aside time to do that for one of the customers that's got quite a complex structure, international structure, and is transferring data to the US. So what shall I do? And we said, put it to the customer, but I suggest we just kind of hold fire. I'm burning a load of time writing SCCs, which probably in 3 months' time are going to be relevant. Let's just put a pause on it because they're not in place now. We're not going to get them in place in the next few weeks, I don't think, through their approvals process and everything. So, we may as well sit back and wait. But, we're in a bit of a limbo land again, aren't we? Because if we're sitting back and waiting, then we are in breach of the regulation. And then there's got to be a process for those people that want to sign up to this privacy framework, because it is, as Fiona quite rightly says, self-certification. People want to sign up, they've got to find how to sign up for it, they've got to maybe go through some sort of assessment process. It is self-assessment, but it's still the process to go through, isn't it? So that might take time. So it leaves us in this limbo position for how many months? I don't know.
I know.
Yeah. I did take some key points away. I don't know if you want to hear them of the framework itself.
Of course.
These were the takeaways for me. So they said that a court tribunal that has powers, complaints and remediation, data protection review court who are independent.
There's an independent. Yeah.
It's clear under the framework that Section 702 of FISA, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, are subject to all of the reforms that are described within the framework. There's a redress mechanism, so the right to file complaints. needs to be approved by the Department of Justice, and the US is in the process of that now. And the last takeaway I got from it was that Schrems 3 is on the way.
Yeah.
Well, that was no surprise. So in the structure of it is, I mean, I read through the whole thing yesterday and it's quite interesting. So, you know, there are these principles. I think there's seven principles. Mm. And then there's, you know, the principles are, you know, the people notice of processing. There's got to be a choice. There's onboard transfer principle, the security principle, purpose imitation principle. So it's a similar kind of stuff, but with a different title, access principle and a principle of recourse. And then there's a lot of blurb in the middle, and all the paragraphs about the principles and protection against unauthorized processing and onboard transfers and enforcement. That goes through all the, you know, paragraph 23 down to 201, go through, you know, access by the state for, it splits that into two actually, doesn't it? Access by the state for law enforcement purposes, criminal law enforcement purposes, and the only mechanisms that the law enforcement agencies have got are warrants, subpoenas, and, you know, law, where the law permits them to access data. So the one that's really problematic, I think, is access by the state for national security, which is why FISA 702 comes in. But so you've got these seven principles, and then there's 16 supplemental principles, one of which is like HR data. Another one is, you know, access by public authorities, which goes into a bit more detail, you know, and rules around accessing and onboard transfers. And also, interestingly, again, for some of our clients, one around clinical trials, pharmaceutical and medical products. You know, there's a set of principles around accessing data for that. So I thought it was quite a good document to read. It's a little bit wordy, but, and again, it's quite legible. It's quite easy to understand. And there's all these checks and balances and mechanisms in place, which either will or won't work. But, you know, it's still self-assessment, or this annual self-assessment, isn't it? You know, and the other thing it says is that when you've registered, then you're immediately covered by the framework. They've also put in place, in the appendices of the agreement, is Appendix A, which is all the enforcement action the US took on Privacy Shield and Safe Harbor. So again, that's quite interesting to read that.
Right. Mm. Yeah. Touching on Privacy Shield, I saw that the organisations that signed up for Privacy Shield have until the 10th of October, I think, to update the policies and procedures to make sure they're in line with the new data privacy framework. So,
short one turnaround. Thing that I don't understand, like I read a bit around the principles. I didn't really get to Section 702 and how that's been addressed, because I don't understand how that issue has been resolved. And maybe that's what Max Schrems is, you know, arguing against as well. It's due for, FISA's due for renewal at the end of this year anyway. So that might play an effect on this US adequacy decision and arrangement. But if that warrants them to access any information unwarranted, how does this resolve that problem? I don't know if that's something you can answer, Phil, through reading through the...
I'm not sure it does. You know, that's the problem. So there's these mechanisms in place, you know, applying for permission and, you know, independent authorities, and you know, but I don't think it does address it properly, in my opinion. It doesn't, anyway.
Does it simply give people the opportunity to for redress, you know, to make a complaint if they find out that their information has been accessed by US law enforcement? Or I don't know, it just doesn't make sense to me that the US have been granted adequacy based
on... haven't. So that's the key thing that we've got to make sure people understand. The US hasn't been granted adequacy. There's a new framework that is effectively, it grants individual organizations. It doesn't grant them anything, actually. It just basically declares that whilst they're registered under this scheme, that there's a belief that there are sufficient safeguards to provide an adequate or equivalent level of protection for personal data and data subjects' rights as there are in the EU and the UK. So people have been tagging it as an adequacy agreement, and it isn't really, is it?
Yeah, so this framework has supremacy over US law enforcement legislation.
No, we don't have supremacy over it. It's tried to dovetail it into it. Yeah. Which, you know, I'm just flicking through it now to get to that point, you know, that you've raised. So I'll probably have to read a bit more about it, to be honest, read it more thoroughly. That section, processing by the state for national security, is a long section, like 50 paragraphs. long. So there's a lot of twists and turns in it. One thing I noticed as well is that the scope of this excludes media organizations. So personal data that's for publication, broadcast or journalistic purposes, you can't rely on this data protection privacy framework. It's specifically excluded.
Right.
For what purpose? Because they're not.
So, I don't know. I don't know. But basically, if you were a newspaper and you wanted to transfer data to the US for journalistic purposes, you can't rely on this mechanism, according to right. Section 212.
Interesting.
That's what I thought.
has there ever been an arrangement like this before, other than, you know, Privacy Shield and Safe Harbor? Has there ever been like a framework between the EU and other countries, or is it just tends to be the US, does it, or is it?
Well, if you go right back to the 80s when there was the OECD guidelines on international transfers, then that existed and people would sign up to that, or countries would sign up to that, really. I'm not sure, Joe. My awareness is this is the only framework in place with an overseas,
you
know, in another nation, where you're saying, well, these organisations that agree to stick to these rules, it's fine.
Yeah, I guess it's because in America there's what, 53 states? I'm not sure on the number, but you can't have adequacy in each specific state, or you can, but it would take ages, wouldn't it? Because they all have their own separate privacy laws.
Yeah, you got a federal law, haven't you? I mean, same in Germany. You know, Germany, you've got a federation of 14 Länders, and you've got a federal data protection act, and you've got individual acts in each of those states. And some states, like I think Bavaria, is much more of a kind of a free state than you know, other states in the German system. That's just the way it is.
Sorry, bit of feedback, I think that was.
Shane's asked in the chat, does the media exemption apply to Meta?
I don't know. I'd have to reread it, but I just noticed that it didn't say social media. It said it's actually personal data for publication, broadcast, and journalistic purposes is exempt. Let me just flick back through to that whilst you're all talking amongst yourselves.
Yeah. I found it interesting that you know, it's similar to a clause in Article 28 for data processing terms, that the onward transfer principle, or I don't know if you call it the mechanism, where if the US organization that signed up to this framework then forward data on to a third party, whether it's in the US or another third country, they have to comply with or provide the same level of protection as under the framework as well.
Yeah, so it says here that the protection afforded under the EU-US data protection framework applies to any personal data transferred from the Union to organisations in the US that have certified their adherence to the principles with the Department of Commerce, with the exception of data that is collected for publication, broadcast or other forms of public communication or journalistic material, and information in previously published material disseminated from media archives. So, quite possibly Meta is excluded from being able to rely on this.
Would you say partially, maybe, depending on what purpose it's used for?
Yeah, because obviously it's got quite broad processing activities. Yeah. Some of it might be okay, but personal data specifically for those purposes are explicitly excluded.
That doesn't surprise me, really, with the things that's been going on in the news with Meta. Maybe do you reckon that's why they're trying to keep them out of being able to sign up to it? Because
I don't know. But I mean, it's a great question that Shane's posed. We'll have to see how it all works its way through the system.
Yeah, I think we'll have a dedicated session to it, won't we? Probably October time when we find more stuff out about the UK data bridge, and we can properly break through it then, can't we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So currently where we're sat at the moment until the fall, as you quite rightly say, is that potentially, you know, a multinational corporation can rely on some transfers for bits of its operations and is SCC'd for the other until we've caught up.
Yeah. I'll be interested to see how it develops, especially if it gets challenged as well. So we might just be in the same place in the next few months.
Well, it's the third time, you know, we've tried to get something in place.
Yeah, third time lucky.
You never know.
So the main session is on special category data lawful basis. So it's called Beyond Consent, but I don't know if that's the most appropriate title for this, because I feel like with special category data, a lot of the time explicit consent might be the most appropriate, just, you know, due to the requirement for stronger or more stringent safeguards around it.
Yeah. The other ones are harder to meet, aren't they, for organisations in order to rely on them as a lawful basis. You are right that when you're processing special category data, explicit consent is typically the most common, unless you disagree with me, Phil.
I it's one of the least I find, actually, looking at other people's ROPAs. Only observation. I might be wrong, but I mean, you do more of this type of work than I do, Joe, but I don't see explicit consent. Usually, like employment processing is usually employment law, you know, medical stuff is usually medical. And very often, you know, the other things like equal opportunity monitoring is a substantial public interest. So I don't see explicit consent often at all. Why do you say it's probably the most common?
I just think that, you know, there's a lot more situations in which consent is the only basis, whereas I don't think you really find that in under Article 6 as much. I was thinking specifically about that case where you worked on it with Vicky as well. It was a arthritis charity who wanted to contact, I think, people that they supported with arthritis just to see how they were getting on. I'm not sure the purposes for it. And they couldn't, the only basis that they could rely on was explicit consent. I remember Vicky doing further research, I think, on Oxfam's privacy policy and so on, and they rely on explicit consent for so much, maybe where there's no, you know, for example, for health data, where there's no health medical professional and so on.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't, I mean, this is what we're trying to get into today, isn't it? Like all the various conditions. So these, you know, if you kind of look at it from the top, you know, we know what special category data is, don't we? But I mean, it's an interesting definition, isn't it? Personal data revealing, racial, ethnic origin, political business. So not actually necessarily, you know, explicitly saying, you know, this person has got this characteristic. Yeah. It's anything which might be a combination of data that reveals ethnic origin, racial origin, political opinions, religious or philosophical beliefs, or trade union membership. So the special category definition, I think is really interesting. So anything that personal data reveals those things is special category data. Genetic data is flagged as special category data. And biometric data, only where it's used for the purpose of uniquely identifying somebody, like retinal scanning or fingerprinting or whatever. So and then you've got data concerning health, you know, without any kind of caveats, and data concerning a natural person's sex life or sexual orientation. So the language of the Article 9, I find quite interesting. I like it, the way that this lot is revealing, that lot is specific, and that lot is concerning.
Yeah.
Data concerning, of course, health is very broad, isn't it?
And of course, it's a general prohibition, isn't it? You know, this sort of data can't be processed unless you can meet one of these Article 9 conditions. Yeah. And I think those Article 9 conditions, I kind of break them into two groups. You know, there's if we've got explicit consent, vital interest, data made public by the data subject, courts and legal defence. Well, that's kind of one group. You've then got a group of processing permitted by law, which is employment purposes, medical purposes, archiving in the public interest, public health and public interest, which we'll dive into in a minute.
Yeah.
And then you've got this really odd one, which I think we were looking at in the case you were mentioning, which is not processing carried out by not-for-profit organisations, where, you know, it's and there's a lot of caveats. So I kind of worked this one through before the session, just thinking, well, what does that actually mean in practice? So I thought, well, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, for instance, CND, is an organization campaigning for nuclear disarmament and peace, which to me is a kind of political aim. So you can join that. I just found you can join CND as a member for £36 a year. So if you join that, you know, does that reveal a political opinion? You know, arguably it does. Yeah, let's say that. So processing special category data, i.e. that, you know, personal data reveals a political opinion, is permitted, providing you can meet these qualification criteria. So it's got to be carried out in the course of CND's legitimate activities. So again, what are those? Do they need documenting? Yes, they probably do. You know, what's the core part of what they're trying to achieve? CND has to have implemented appropriate safeguards. So if you look through the definition, all I've done is broken it out to try and get my head around it. And the processing can only relate solely to the members or to the former members of the organisation. So that's another limitation. Or the processing solely relates to persons who have regular contact with it in connection with its purposes. And then finally, the special category data can't be disclosed outside CND without the consent of the data subjects. So that kind of breaks down that Article 9.2d thing. And so I think there's kind of, I group them in my head as three things. As you've got explicit consent by law, so you've got personal privacy by law, and then you've got that one that kind of stands out on its own with a lot of conditions you got to meet, yeah. but nothing relating to law in there.
With that one, I was thinking about this earlier. So I was talking with Vicky about that that case with the charity, and to what extent you could argue that something was for a philosophical aim or belief within a not-for-profit body. You know, if you have a charity, so that charity provides support to people with arthritis. What could you not argue that it's in their philosophical beliefs to you know, to help people with this condition or whatnot? Or obviously that might sound like a bit of a stretch, but I don't know. I've never really come across that one either in practice. I don't know if anyone else has that wants to speak out, but
I'm just doing a quick Googling what the definition of philosophical beliefs is.
I was about to say that's quite a broad thing, isn't it? Because philosophy is when you, I don't really know, is it just teaching? It's like thinking and trying to like put new theories to test. Is that, would you say that's fair, or am I going down the wrong?
No, yeah, it's a broad concept, really. So,
okay, according to the UK legislation.gov.uk, this is just a Google quick answer. So there's probably a load of other stuff around it. The criteria to determine what is a philosophical belief are that it must be genuinely be held, be a belief, not an opinion or viewpoint, based on the present state of information available, and be a belief as to a weighty and substantial aspect of human life and behaviour. So, quite a chunky thing.
Yeah, what's the difference between a belief and an opinion? How do you determine whether an opinion's a belief or an opinion? You know, if I think something, and you go, that's subjective. Your opinion, Joe. I go, well, that's my belief, Phil.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how you determine, Joe. Of opinion, I'm not a psychologist.
Or a philosopher.
I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, and quite right, too. The whole point of all this stuff is to kick it about, isn't it? You know, we don't just accept things at face value. You know, we are interested in exploring the parameters and trying to get practical examples.
Mm.
Yes.
So David's rightly said in the chat, you would still need an Article 6 condition. Article 9 is on top of Article 6.
Quite so. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of the time as well, they'll they'll coincide quite nicely. So vital interest and vital interest, consent, and so on. Legal obligation.
Yeah, legitimate and, interest. Yeah.
But I think for the one you were discussing last, my question would be, what would you use as your Article 6 condition? Because you got a very constructed Article 9, you were talking about the philosophical side. What would you use as Article 6? I think that is almost more challenging for that one.
I guess it depends on the activity, doesn't it? Because it's hard to establish what type of activity it would be in which you can rely on that basis. Well, me, I'd have to work backwards, and that's where I'm stuck.
Yeah, I would have. I'm going to come back to philosophical bit. On the, if you're referring to the kind of Article 9.2d, the not-for-profit foundations thing, because it says processing is carried out in the course of its legitimate activities, I would have expected kind of a legitimate interest to be established as the Article 6 basis, and then you'd be relying on this Article 9.2d as your Article 9 basis. But the philosophical discussion has just got really philosophical. But in terms of the philosophical, that's just a type of personal data, isn't it? That's just a type of special category data.
Amy said in the chat, veganism as a belief that eating animals is wrong. It becomes a philosophy when you live it and do not use any form of product made or tested with or on animals. That's usually my brief explanation for a difference that is relevant anyway.
Thank you for that. That's helpful, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is.
Yeah. In fact, I kind of had a quick think about which types of organisations might be a not-for-profit foundation with a political, philosophical, etc. aim, and there's quite, you know, there's quite a lot that came up in the list, you know, all sorts of charities, and but the Vegan Society was one of those that came up in the, list of those top types of organizations, not-for-profit foundations relating to political, philosophical or religious beliefs. So I think it's a really good example, Amy.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. So I'd say, you know, one of the most common law Article 9 bases tends to be substantial public interest, maybe because that there's, you know, many conditions that need to be met. But it, is, while they're specific, I would say it stretches over a broad range of activities under Schedule 1 of the Data Protection Act. Would you agree with that, Phil? You're frowning.
No, I'm not. I'm not frowning at all. No, I'm maybe I'm squinting because of the sun. But apologies, Jasmine. No, but you kind of start off by finding, let's say, processing activities. Like we are doing HR. You know, we're doing ethnic. We're doing equal opportunities monitoring, mm-hmm. right? So that's where the starting point is. We've found in the organisation we either do it or we won't start doing it. So then you're starting to think, well, what's the lawful basis for proposing Article 6? We have a legitimate interest in doing this. We talked about this a few weeks ago. And then you're thinking, okay, well, that's going to be special category data, because that is definitely going to be information revealing racial or ethnic origin. That's the whole purpose of it, isn't it? So you're then thinking, well, what could we do? And actually, there's no clue in Article 9 of the GDPR. The clue is in the Data Protection Act, and knowing that in the old Data Protection Act, there was another kind of supplemental thing about permitting this. So you know it's going to be in there somewhere. So then, you know, if you're going to try and follow the bread trail, you would start off in Article 9, 2G, Substantial Public Interests, and then you'd have a look in the Data Protection Act at Section 11, which then section 10 and 11, which then point you to Schedule 1 of the Data Protection Act. So it's a bit of a kind of piecing together of the pieces, isn't it? Trying to get where you're looking. And then you scroll down through Schedule 1 and you get to section 8. Yeah. And then you look at that and you think, right, okay, well, we are allowed to do this because Section 8 permits us to collect that special kind of data. Limited, it's not sexual orientation, it's not sexual life. It's much more limited range of data you can use for those purposes. Am I right? Sexual orientation not in there? I can't remember now, but it's not everything, is it?
I'm not sure. I didn't know it specified it, to be fair, in Schedule 1.
Yeah, yeah.
I know it's limited in the Equality Act, but...
Yeah.
I'm curious
now. I'll flash it up on screen. It goes through this, so I won't go through the whole bread trail thing, but I may as well share it just so we've got it to have a look at. I know we don't like sharing our screens and doing presentations on this show. We don't do that type of thing. So if you can see it, it's big enough, then you know we scroll through to Schedule 1, you know, equal opportunity for treatment. So it's only these categories of personal data. Oh, it is sexual orientation, it is in there, but sex life isn't. That's what I was thinking. So it's not the full list of special category data, it's certain aspects of special category data relating to certain groups of people. You can only use it for certain purposes that are set out in this section here, you know. And you know, at the end of the day, you can't process to rely on this if you know the person is likely to cause substantial damage or substantial distress, i.e. you've got to do a risk assessment about it. And you know, it's all time bound as well, and people have got a right to object. So processing doesn't meet the condition if an individual has given notice in writing to the controller requiring the controller not to process the personal data. So there's always a right to object there as well on this particular one. But the other thing you need to have, of course, is appropriate policy document. So, you know, the first thing that Schedule 1 says is that anything in this part of the schedule, you must have this appropriate policy document. And I'm interested in the language here. It just says, see also the additional safer. That's not language you're used to seeing in the law, is it? Like, that's just like an advisory rather than it being, you know, a legal statement. So that was a bit strange. That was, and of course, it's in here that your proper policy document is defined what has to be in it, and also that you've got to put these things on Europa, and you've also got to have on Europa, according to Schedule Part 4, you've got to say whether you stick to the retention period, which always foxes me. Why would you bother to ask that question? You know, but anyway, it's in there. And so it goes on. So you know, you find processing in your organization, and then you satisfy Article 6 lawful basis, and then you're into looking in the back of here, saying, well, you know, what are we doing? You know, what can we rely on here? Safeguarding of children and individuals at risk, etc. Then you've got to work through all the qualification criteria, I would call them, all the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yes. So how do we get on here?
It's not easy, is it, the Data Protection Act, though? As you've just demonstrated there, Phil, trying to apply these things is not easy at all. And it's even more confusing when you go and have a read on the ICO's guidance on substantial public interest, because it likes to contradict the Data Protection Act, as me and you discovered just last week, didn't we, Phil? Do you recall?
Yeah.
Put you on the spot.
Well, it's not such it is contradictory, actually, isn't it? So on the ICO's website, they're saying that a substantial public interest has to have broad public interest, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I'll share my screen again here. So
yeah,
you were challenging me.
Yeah, I've got what the guidance says if you want me to read through it. So on the website, it says that the term substantial public interest is not defined in the DPA 2018 or the UK GDPR. And some of the conditions assume that processing under the condition is always in the substantial public interest. For example, ensuring equality or preventing fraud. However, some only apply to the extent that the processing is necessary for reasons of substantial public interest. The public interest covers a wide range of values and principles relating to the public good or what is in the best interests of society. Commercial or private interests are not the same as public interest. And if you need to point to reasons of substantial public interest, it is not enough to point to your own interests. Of course, you can still have a private interest. You need to make sure that you can also point to a wider public benefit. Additionally, many of the substantial public interest conditions only apply if there is a good reason why you cannot get valid explicit consent.
Yes, yeah, so that to us suggests that it's got to have broad appeal, doesn't it? And doesn't
Definitely.
Really relate to individuals. But yeah, in said Schedule 1 Part 2, you know, there is a condition here, support for individuals with a particular disability or medical condition, and this one here, safeguarding of children or individuals at risk. Now this is down to individuals, you know, so we were kind of racking our brains on this. The public interest must be to ensure that these individuals are appropriately looked after, but that definition doesn't seem to accommodate these lawful basis processes, which are definitely individually orientated.
Yeah,
in my opinion. Well, what do I know?
I agree now.
Now we've got a couple of questions in the chat. How does a private company manage to rely on a substantive public interest? Why, if this is listed in the legislation, would this not just be a 2B? 2B.
That's employment law, I'm assuming. That's what you mean by 2B.
It is, Jasmine, yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking about this earlier. So say with collection of equal opportunities related data when monitoring purposes, what would you choose? Would you choose to rely on Article 92B, which is processed under employment law, or substantial public interest? And I know that you know, some of the protected characteristics are specified under the Equality Act, but and to be fair, I didn't look to see who that applies to, who's caught by that. I also looked in the Employment Act, where I couldn't find anything specifically. This was a quick glance about 10 minutes before the session. Yeah. I just got a thought.
And nothing like preparation, Jasmine.
It was just a quick thought that came to me, and then I was scrambling as soon as someone started the session.
Well, that's the thing. The employment law, I don't sufficiently know employment law, but if there's nothing that explicitly permits that processing, then you wouldn't be able to rely on that employment law. Or you know, there might be other employment law. I don't know enough about employment law to comment on that. But you know, again, some people might have a look and say, well, you know, there's all these caveats on this equal opportunities monitoring thing. So is there an easier way of doing it? I don't know how people approach it. I mean,
I think with employment law as well, you know, you've got to point to a specific piece of legislation in which you can rely on it. But how specific do you go? You know, if something's not absolutely necessary, if some type of personal data isn't absolutely necessary to comply with that piece of legislation, then could you rely on it, or do you look at it more broadly?
I don't think you should. I think that the GDPR has a general prohibition. It says you can't process this type of information. It's basically, unless you've got a really good reason to, either, you know, these type of things, or these things permitted by law. Now, if that if it's not permitted by law, then it's not covered, is it, in my opinion?
Mm-hmm.
But it also, it's not just employment law, it's employment, it's in the field of employment law, social security law, and social protection law. So there's three different kind of classes of law to have a look at. So social security law might be things like the Social Security Act, the Welfare Reform Act, the personal independence payment regulations. There's quite a few, yeah, social security claims and payment regulations. There's quite a bit of social security law. And social protection law might include Child Benefit Act and the Children's Act and the Maternity and Parental Leave regulations, Care Act, Equality Act. So you know, you've got a lot of places to look to try and find if what you want to do is permitted in the law, those laws.
Melissa,
good general feel. If it doesn't feel right, it's usually not right. If it feels right, then, you know, usually there's a mechanism somewhere, we've just got to find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Melissa said in the chat, wanted to ask, I work as a data protection officer for when you request the loan for medical care, they request you to share medical records, but it's not shared to our office, it is kept by our insurer. Can we say that we don't process special categories of data?
Like, if that'd be a matter of fact, won't it? Either they do or they don't. I wouldn't have thought the insurer would be a processor. I would have thought they'd be a separate controller. I've worked for a data protection officer for when you request a loan for medical care, they request who they is. The bank, presumably. But if you're not having access to those data, if you're not, you know, processing is a broad term, if you're not collecting it, using it, storing it, you know, doing other things with special category data, with that medical information, then, you know, you wouldn't be processing it. If you are accessing it, storing it, reviewing it, then you will be processing it. So I think it requires a really good look at, you know, what actually happens in that part of the operation to figure out, well, what are we processing it or not? And if you're not processing it, because it's not necessary if you're part of the operation, then, you know, great, you don't have to comply with the Article 9 condition. But if you want to jump on, Melissa, and kind of fill in the gaps, if we might not fully understand the question or have articulated it well, but by all means jump on. Otherwise, we'll just carry on. But if you want to say anything, just unmute and start talking, and we'll be quiet. So, the medical purposes one is interesting, isn't it, as well? So Article 92H, that's another interesting one. Processing necessary for the purposes of preventative or occupational medicine. It's quite broad, isn't it? You know, the assessment of the working capacity of an employee, medical diagnosis, the provision of health or social care treatment, or the management of health or social care systems and services. All those kind of things. Again, you know, there's another paragraph later on in Article 9, which is about, you know, national competencies and bodies and medical secrecy laws and rules and so on and so forth. But that's another one that is quite often used, isn't it? Because it's relating to the workplace, occupational medicine, assessing the working capacity of an employee, is all relevant to employment processing.
Mm.
Have you seen that one much?
Not through the customers that I've worked with personally, but from a distance, from, you know, other people in the team occasionally, but I've not had hands-on experience with it myself, really.
Yeah, I can't say I've seen that come through the support desk.
Yeah. So which other substantial public interest conditions do you come? Because when we come across this safeguarding of individuals at risk and children, don't we, quite frequently? Because a lot of our housing clients, you know, they've got some vulnerable tenants, and, you know, they're trying to collect special category data, or they're creating special category data, you know, information revealing, et cetera, et cetera. And then they're looking towards this sort of Section 18 as a lawful basis for processing, aren't they? That's one we've come across quite a lot.
Yeah,
preventing or detecting unlawful acts quite often as well, to be fair, as a basis. But that can be used for criminal offence data more specifically, in accordance with Article 10. Not Article 10. Is it Article 10?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah. Yeah. The criminal offence data, I think, is, again, it's quite an interesting one because it's not classified under the GDPR as special category data, is it? It's got its own kind of definition. Yeah. But when you look inside of the Data Protection Act, it gets treated the same as special category data. You know, you still have to look for Schedule 1 condition to process criminal conviction and offence data. So, again, that's another one of those things we need to be aware of. I'm sure everyone, you know, been around the block enough to know that it was classified as special category data in the 98 Act, but it was declassified in the GDPR, but then caught by the Data Protection Act, which, again, I think is quite an interesting little twist. Mm.
It's another of those as well, similar to, say, data concerning health, that you need to be careful of, because specifying that someone doesn't have a criminal offence amounts to criminal offence data. So, you know, you'd need to make sure that you've got appropriate measures in place for that. A lot of people, you know, or organisations, even when they do DBS checks, they think that keeping a record of the fact that no one's, you know, that an individual doesn't have an offence is fine and isn't caught where it is.
Yeah, but then quite narrowly construed, aren't there, these conditions? So, you know, you do need to, and they're not, in some cases, well written. You've got to, I find, copy and paste and break it up and reword it, you know, making sure you don't lose the essence of it. But in order to get it into an intelligible set of sort of a decision tree, right, we've got to satisfy that condition, that condition, that condition. You kind of need to rework those things in my experience anyway. So did you say you'd been doing some work on substantial public interest this week, Joe?
Yes, I've carried out two substantial public interest assessments, my first ones.
And how did that go? What did you do? How did you approach it?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was a little bit out of my comfort zone because I've not really done anything on that before. Luckily, Jasmine, actually, you did one on the same customer about 18 months ago. So I took the template that Jasmine used and tweaked it a little bit. And then they're very similar to legitimate interest assessments, but they go a lot further. I want to say they're similar in the terms that, you know, you're stating the processing that you're doing, the condition you want to rely on, how you meet that condition, and then you're weighing up the rights and the freedoms of the individuals and whether there's a risk to those and whether the substantial public condition is appropriate or not. But it was interesting. We don't really get too much of those come through the support desk, actually. I think that's the first time I've seen them since I've been in the support desk. I'm not sure whether you can talk on, Jasmine, when your experience when you were in the support desk. Did you see many substantial public interest assessments?
Yeah, I saw a few, typically on the same kinds of activities, really, mostly around EDI data, quality of opportunities monitoring. So it was quite straightforward, really, after so long.
Yeah. Whenever I'm doing any training on this subject, the two things I start off looking at are the equal opportunity monitoring and then the anti-doping in sport, which is really quite specific, isn't it? And kind of could be a surprise that that's actually defined in the Data Protection Act as one of those lawful bases in the public substantial public interest condition. But when you're kind of talking to people, you say, well, you know, it seems right, doesn't it, that we can process this kind of information, you know, as long as it's not upsetting people and they've got a right to opt out, you know, in order to make sure we're applying equality of opportunity. And the same as anti-doping in sport, you know, it wouldn't be right if explicit consent was the only option there. You know, these are two really good, I think, examples where you say, well, you know, so if it feels right, it is right. So let's have a look at these two bits in here. Just a bit of a side note, I've spent quite a bit of time this week revisiting, which we need to have another session on, the process of due diligence. But that caused me to go back over the European Data Protection Board guidance and actually some law legal advice from Bird and Bird, which is a good data protection law firm, in order to kind of revisit, you know, what we do and why we do it and how we do it. And I'm quite interested to have another session on that at some point in a bit more detail.
Yeah, I think we could probably talk at length about due diligence. It's been a hot topic, hasn't it, in the office over the past few weeks?
Yeah, it has, because we won't go into
it. It's not easy, though, is it? No, we won't. We'll leave it at that. It's not easy. One thing I did want to mention on while we're talking about special category data was I get through quite often on the support desk our customers want to carry out surveying, and they want to collect EDI data for, you know, various reasons, and they try and say that the survey is going to be anonymous. However, when you are processing special category data, it can actually infer identifiable to an individual. I'm not sure if you do you know what I'm saying. So the more granular you go on the stuff that you're collecting, so if you're collecting, if I'm sending a survey out to you guys or to DPP, and I'm collecting age brackets, and I'm collecting religion, and I'm collecting disability data, and I'm maybe location of where you are within the country, although I've not necessarily got your name, if there's, you know, if there's only one person that ticks some of those boxes, you know, in theory, you can identify those, that person, through the special category data.
Absolutely. And this is kind of an extension of your cookie discussion, isn't it? You know, given enough data points, you know, everybody becomes identifiable, i.e. distinctly identifiable from somebody else.
Yeah.
So, you know, the definition isn't that you can actually stick a name and a picture on them, is if they're distinctly identifiable. So I absolutely agree with you, Joe. And that's one of the things that, again, it's a tough thing about personal data. Information changes its form. It kind of morphs from being just data to being personal data just over the course of time. And that's one of the things we've really got to guard against, you know, as privacy practitioners, is making sure that, you know, we are absolutely fully aware of what we're processing.
And on that point as well, with anonymization, being absolutely sure that something, if you believe it to be anonymized, it actually is anonymized, and reviewing anything that, you know, that is supposedly anonymized, because even before you start a processing activity, going through those, you know, those questions of whether you can say 100% for certain that this will be anonymous data, and if not, putting in measures in place such as an appropriate lawful basis in the instance that you might collect personal data.
Yeah, I had one instance that sticks out for me actually on this. I reviewed a DPAA for one of our customers, and I sat through it, and it was about 30 pages, and it took me a fair amount of time, and I got to the end, and they were saying throughout that it's anonymous. The surveys were sending out, it was EDI data, same purpose, and it's anonymous. And I got right to the end, and they said the risk is that someone could, in theory, be identified. And I just sat there, like, I've just gone through all of that. You know, they're saying, you know, obviously, if they're anonymous, they're not caught by the GDPR, are they? So I was just sat there thinking, what is going on here? But it, like you say, Jasmine, it's so important, isn't it, to be 100% sure that someone cannot be anonymized. And if it's a small enough sample, and it's very granular in how far you're going on the data you're collecting, the chances are you are probably going to be able to identify one individual from the group, and therefore are caught.
Yeah, you might identify from handwriting as well.
Yeah, you know, possibly. Well,
if it's a written thing. As an aside, I remember doing some training at a place in Manchester, and just to kind of get the thing rolling, I sent around this signing in form, and on the signing in form was name, job title, sexual orientation, and people filled it in. So I've never done it since, because I was so mortified that they actually thought it was a genuine thing. I expected them to challenge me and say, what's a lawful basis for proposing this? I just thought it was really quite funny you putting it on the signing in sheet. But then when people filled in, I was mortified.
Who was that training to? Was it to practitioners, or was it just to...
Yeah, it was
clearly
to,
why they needed training.
a group of managers at a housing association.
Yeah, because before I joined DPP, I would never question anything, I don't think. But now I read things and I'm filling stuff out, and I'm like, why the hell do you need to collect this information about me for something, you know, like signing up for an email or something, and they're collecting God knows what data. I'm always sat now questioning it. So I guess that's not the worst thing to get out of this job.
No. So cool. We're meant to be talking about beyond consent.
Something that relates to the data privacy framework that I read earlier was that where it ties in with further processing. So the purpose limitation principle and further processing. So where you or an organisation further processes information that is materially different but not incompatible with the original purpose, you should collect, as a general rule, consent from the data subject, unless you can, what did they call it, express consent. I don't know why they don't just keep it all the same terminology, but anyway, I'm not going to go down that route because I'll start ranting. But yeah, unless, you know, there's a vital interest or it's for the defense of legal claims, etc. So yeah, I noticed that. I thought.
So what you're saying is that in the data protection framework, mm-hmm. if you want to process data for some other purpose other than is closely what's aligned collected. To what you collected for in the first place, then, because of course this applies to controllers and processors, the FDR, doesn't it? Then the only option it says in there is consent. So you can't say we're going to extend the processing to these new types of activities for these new purposes, and we're going to rely on a legitimate interest. Point, what you're saying is, come to the FDR.
Well, this is for special category data.
Oh, special category data, right?
Yeah, but it was similar for just normal personal data, but specifically as well with special category data, you need to collect express consent. But exceptions include vital interests, processing necessary for the establishment of legal claims, or where it is required to provide medical care or diagnosis.
Right.
But
right,
I don't understand then how that ties in with Section 702 of FISA, where law enforcement, I guess, legal claim is.
Well, when we get on to looking at the in a couple of weeks' time, we'll have delve into that and have some answers. I wondered what you made of data made public. So, you know, Article 9.2e. So special category data can be processed where it's been is it manifestly made public by the data subject? You know, what do we think is making public? You know, is putting it on Facebook public? Is it putting on LinkedIn public? Is it sending it to a mate on WhatsApp public? You know, how public does it have to be?
I think we've made this we've had this debate you know, a few times, haven't we? But to my mind, it would be, say if you post it on social media and you've got a public account, sending it over WhatsApp, no, I wouldn't even say that's caught by the, well, none of it really would be caught by GDPR if it's an individual making it public.
How public is public? Is what's Facebook users? 3 billion? What if you put it on, what's that new one? Twitter? No, what, Tweet?
Threads.
Threads, that's the one.
I should let you keep going then.
has that got 100,000? Has it got 100 million users, is it?
Has it already? I've seen there's a lot of privacy concerns with that.
How public does it have to be? What if it was a really small, itty-bitty, you know, like a very small, you know, private group on WhatsApp then? How many people would it count to be classified as made public, made public?
I think you've answered your question there by saying it's a private group, even if there's so many people on there. I think public is, it's public knowledge. Everyone knows it. I mean, well, I guess it's not easy to manage, is it? I guess, but
would you say it's something that could be made accessible to anyone? Maybe.
Well, I don't know. I just wondered, like, because I don't, not everyone uses Facebook, so why would that suddenly qualify, or Meta, whatever it's now called?
It could be a public platform, couldn't it? Really, I don't know.
Stick it on a billboard. Put it in a newspaper.
Yeah, well, that was my my thought process. Was the newspaper
potentially is telling one other person potentially? I'm just interested to where are those parameters?
I don't think they generally exist as a. I don't think you can generalize it really. It's just a case by case basis, isn't it?
Yeah, I have seen I can't remember the detail. I have seen a legal case on this. Which was involved in social media. It was a couple of years ago, and I can't remember the details. But again, it's just, you know, how the brain ticks over and ponders these points. Now, cool, we've got 3 minutes left. Now, what else do we need to cover off on beyond consent?
Apologise because we've really not been keeping up with this chat.
is it more chat? I thought we were on Melissa still.
I think people have been putting things in, and then others have been responding and helping each other out. They've been doing our job.
Yeah, Michael's made a good point. So he was reading an article recently that talks about preventing or detecting unlawful acts as a basis for substantial public interest from processing special category data. but also reference the distinction when using the prevention or detection of crime exemption under Schedule 2 exemptions when sharing data with the police, such as CCTV footage from a shop. He thought that was quite interesting, which it is. I'm not very good at picking out the best ones as I go along.
My chat was stuck on Melissa's comment from earlier on.
As it's called Beyond Consent, and we've spoken a little bit about explicit consent. Are we? Do we think we're familiar with what explicit consent means? Do we think we've got that down to a T?
Well, I just want what's the difference between consent and explicit consent? I mean, interested also in that kind of prohibition where, except where the UK law provides that the prohibition referred to in paragraph one may not be lifted by the data subject. I mean, kind of like, I just have to stop and think about, well, what's all that about then? So if the law dictates that certain genetic data must remain anonymized, for instance, a data subject doesn't have the power to grant consent for it to be processed. So again, there's a few bits around explicit consent that you have to think, why is that there? How does that work in practice? But yeah, you're right about, what is the difference between consent and explicit consent? Consent's got quite a defined definition, hasn't it?
Very, yeah. So the way I see it is, I think Vicky actually helped me with this, was that explicit consent is, it's more than just ticking a box. So it's, it's doing a, like, consent, you can tick a box, right? But explicit consent, it's got to be more. It's got to be above and beyond just normal consent. So I think a good example is a signature, for example, would be explicit. So saying I explicitly consent to this and then signing that document off, I would say that meets explicit consent.
Specifying that, you're consenting to the processing of special category data or the specific special category data that's in question.
But I just don't see how consent can be valid if it's got to be a clear, unambiguous indication of a data subject's wishes, blah, blah, blah. I struggle a little bit with, well, what's explicit consent as opposed to consent? Before we go any further, I have to say a big call out and a big thank you to Steph. I've just scrolled through because Steph spent a bit of time with Joe and I. Was it last week? Was it last week or this week? The time's morphing into one.
And Jasmine.
Running through some of the stuff we talked about last week on cookies and pixels. So thank you very much, Steph, for giving it your time. It was really helpful and really useful and very kind of you to do that. And when we come back to this topic again, if you're happy to do it, maybe we'll kind of do a double act and get you on to run through some of the things you worked with Joe and Jasmine and I on. So much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you.
So explicit consent, we've virtually run out of time, unfortunately, but I don't know too old is. I think you're talking about you two. So I don't really know why consent and explicit consent. I think it's just saying you've got to have a specific statement, relating to the special category data.
So what you're saying is because it's unambiguous and it's explicit enough as it is, consent is explicit, isn't it, really?
But well, I take that as it's got to be specific to the special category data. So not the processing activity, the actual special category data in question. So, for example, I consent to X undertaking this processing in relation to my heart disease. And then,
calm down if you're in that state.
I consent to X collecting health data about me for this purpose. If that makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense. Of course it makes sense. But again,
but in a way of, if that makes sense in terms of that's what it means, is that I think that's the difference. It's just got to be, see your point. But I guess break down more specifically the type of data that's collected in that instance.
Fair enough, but I think that's covered by consent. but I mean, it's different, isn't it? I mean, it must be different, otherwise it wouldn't have that word explicit in front of it. Yeah. I remember we had the ICO, we have to finish in a minute, but we had the ICO talk at one of our events when we were in the Round Foundry, not the ICO herself, but one of their senior staff. And at the time the GDPR was coming in, we held a seminar, and this chap stood up and he said, all these people put all these different words in front of consent, implied consent, almost consent, whatever else consent. And he said, you know, consent is consent. Nothing can go in front of it. That's what I said. Anyway. So what have you got on next week?
Next week,
I think we've run out
is...
of time, I'm afraid. Now, what have you got on next week? What are you doing? I'm in France on holiday.
I'm thinking
Very
about the weekend.
Nice.
I'm not thinking about next week yet. But the next session is a GDPR radio session where we talk about current news and, you know, our views and whatnot. But both of you away. Both of you abandoning
yeah,
me next week.
I'm not here either.
Yeah. So I'm going to have to recruit.
If anyone wants to apply for a temporary session, stick your name in the chat and Jasmine can reach out to you.
But yeah, I hope you have a good time next week on your jollies anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you everyone for joining. I will see you next week for the next session. So have a good weekend in the meantime.
Thank you, Jazz. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, everyone.